Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 124. Today's guest is a guy who joined us during this past offseason and trained with us at CSP Florida throughout the lockout. Super hard worker, really intelligent guy, got a unique delivery, but what's awesome about it is he's a young pitcher who really understands why that unique works for him, which is, you know, something that's very rare in today's game. He's a great listener and was able to leverage a lot of the time he got around some of our big league veterans to get better and better. And it's really, you know, shown up in how well his results have materialized this season. So really articulate guy who's going to be an excellent interview. I enjoyed it and I'm sure you will too. Today's episode is brought to you by Proteus Motion. Proteus Motion's patented technology is the only way to measure strength and power for every human movement. To date, it's only been possible to measure physical strength and power for movements in a straight line, similar to a squat and bench press. However, less than 5% of human movement is actually taking place in a straight line. The Proteus system allows us to measure power for the overwhelming majority of human movements for the first time ever. Proteus software guides users through a 4-minute physical assessment to arm trainers with unprecedented performance data and insights, creating an entirely new standard for personalized fitness and physical rehabilitation. All this is enabled by a total reinvention of resistance training called 3D resistance. Training power and acceleration with Proteus's patented 3D resistance is safer and can be more efficient and more effective than traditional resistance training tools, depending on the circumstances. On a personal level, I've been a big fan of Proteus for the past few years. We have a unit in both Cressy Sports Performance facilities and actually helped to develop the Cressy Power Test for rotational athletes. The information we've gathered from this testing has been an absolute game changer in helping us to develop more optimal programs for our athletes. Additionally, as a training initiative, work on the Proteus has allowed us to train different points on the force velocity curve and rotational patterns in ways that medicine ball work never could. You can learn more about them by listening to episode 106 of this Elite Baseball Development Podcast or by heading to www.proteusmotion.com. Again, that's proteusmotion.com, P-R-O-T-E-U-S, motion.com. I promise that you won't be disappointed. Today's guest grew up as a two-way player in New Rochelle, New York, and attended Division II LeVoyne College in Syracuse. After splitting time as a shortstop and pitcher his first 2 years, he turned his focus exclusively to pitching as a sophomore when he was the closer and had an ERA of .63. That summer, he played for the Chatham Anglers of the Cape Cod Baseball League, and as a junior in 2018, he went 11-0 with a 1.25 ERA in 13 starts. The Cincinnati Reds drafted him in the second round with the 72nd overall pick of the 2018 MLB draft. That December, he was traded to the Dodgers, where he eventually made his major league debut in July of 2021. Not long after that debut, he was again traded, this time to the Washington Nationals in the deal that sent Max Scherzer and Trey Turner to the Dodgers. With 19 career starts under his belt at the time of this recording, he's now established himself as a mainstay in the Nationals starting rotation. Please welcome to the show, Josiah Gray. Josiah, thanks so much for joining us, man. I'm excited for this.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad to be on, glad to share my story and you know, answer some questions.
We lined this up really well. You had an outstanding outing yesterday, and it's always good to get somebody on a high note. So we'll try to build on that momentum and get a good podcast out of it too.
Sure.
But hey, I know we've had some really cool conversations about your development, both kind of being an under the radar guy early on, and then obviously, you know, working your way through multiple organizations. So I think the best place to start it is to maybe talk about like the high school years. You're in New Rochelle, New York, right?
Yep.
Tom Kohlerland, another previous guest. Talking about you as a high school athlete, were you a multi-sport guy? Were you baseball only? What was the path?
So I was just baseball only. Honestly, as a kid growing up, it was all I wanted to do was play baseball. But what I had working for me was that I played shortstop as well. So I would play short, I'd pitch, and I'd alternate the two. So I remained like that athleticism, but it wasn't a multi-sport, I guess you can say.
I gotcha. So I'm curious, like one of the things that we often see with like the Northeast, I guess, position player is, you know, they're really hard to evaluate, right? You don't see these guys facing like 95 mile an hour arms like kids get in Florida and Texas and California. Like what was the challenge? Cause you obviously weren't like super heavily recruited out of high school. Mm-hmm. Was it that they just didn't see you enough? Was it that, you know, they didn't know you as a pitcher, they only knew you as a position player? What was it?
Honestly, I think it was just, they didn't know of me as much because I was a decent player in high school. You know, I was going out pitching well, and I would play a decent shortstop. But, you know, the offers or the looks just never came. And I think it just was, you know, a culmination of probably just summer baseball as well, you know, not getting in front of the right schools and, you know, guys not wanting to, you know, go look at that NHL kid. So, unfortunately, I went under the radar and, you know, ended up at Lemoyne. But, yeah, there, you know, there were guys that I played high school baseball against that, you know, went on to Division I schools. And, you know, I felt like I was comparable to them on the field. But, you know, those offers just never came for me.
So you obviously wound up at Lemoyne. And I'm always fascinated about developmental paths because I think so many people from the outside assume that, like, every big leaguer they encountered, you know, went to Texas or Vanderbilt or LSU or something like that. And there are just as many that come from smaller schools, junior colleges, things like that. But, you know, what's interesting about you is, like, you obviously went to a place where you could play right away. Mm-hmm. And you struggled as a freshman, right? I mean, you know, I think mm-hmm. I'm looking it up. You batted 265. You had, like, an 8.31 ERA. Like, it wasn't just like you rolled in and dominated Division II baseball. Mm-hmm. Like, there was an adjustment. What was the challenge in that first year?
I think it was just getting acclimated to the college game. You know, I started to put on some weight. So, you know, the ball was coming out a little bit better. I was hitting the ball a little bit harder. But, you know, my, I guess the strikes and the swing and misses I would get in high school, I wasn't getting those in college. And early on in my college career, I was getting hit around a lot. And then towards the end of the year, you know, the coach, Scott Cassidy, who's still the coach there, he kind of enlisted me to get, you know, bigger innings and in better spots. And, you know, I ended up turning the tide there on the mound. But at the plate, you know, it was just seeing better velo, seeing better breaking balls, and kind of that adjustment took a while for me to, you know, get acclimated to the college game. And it was definitely a struggle, but I think I, you know, hit a stride my sophomore year on the mound, not so much at the plate. But it definitely took a while to get acclimated.
I don't think people realize how many, like, competing demands are for the attention for two-way guys. Like, I use catchers as an example. Like, catchers in Major League Baseball, like, we ask a lot of them to be elite hitters just because it's so much to serve a pitching staff and just the fatigue that goes with catching bullpens and getting to know guys and being involved in pregame planning and stuff. Like, anything they do at the plate is kind of, like, bonus to me.
Absolutely.
But did you find that, like, it was always, like, you know, it makes what Ohtani is doing so much more special. But did you struggle just to kind of put everything in the schedule that you needed to do as both a, you know, a position player and a pitcher?
Absolutely. So my freshman year was more so infield than pitching, but, you know, I would still throw a bullpen here and there. But sophomore year was when it got really complicated scheduling things, because I would have to, you know, have batting practice, early ground balls, things like that. But then I'd still have to, you know, throw a bullpen because I was closing out games for us. So it was like, all right, how do you, you know, make sure you get enough ground balls, throw some short, but also make sure you get, you know, your 15 to 20 pitches off the mound so you're ready for the weekend. So sophomore year was a really tough time scheduling things. And, you know, I came out of that year injury free, but it definitely, you know, puts a lot on your body that, you know, you're not really accustomed to right away.
How did the decision, I know they made you the closer as a sophomore, and you obviously didn't hit as much, like, is that something that kind of came about just organically over the course of time as you were losing at bats slowly, or you were just shoving and that was the highest priority? Was it like a hard conversation you and coach had to have? How did it come about that you basically said pitching's the way?
Yeah, it was a super easy conversation. Actually, my sophomore year, so I was a starting shortstop and I would close out the ninth innings, and we had a really good team. So I wasn't, you know, pressing to start on the mound or anything. But that summer I went out to the Cape Cod League, just pitched. Had a great summer, you know, getting in front of, you know, all the scouts that are out there. And, you know, with my name kind of blowing up, we had a conversation my junior year fall and basically laid it out on the line. Like, one, we want you to be our ace, you know, to go out there every Saturday and, you know, lead us to a win. But also our team, you know, we ended up as high as 10th in the country. And, you know, it was a really good team for us. So, you know, having that be the factor that took the bat away from me, I wasn't mad about it at all, because I knew, you know, the guy that was in there at DH was going to get the job done. And, you know, I was going to go out there every Saturday and do what I needed to do. But it was a super easy conversation. It sort of sucked at first, but I understood. And, you know, looking at it now, you know, that's the conversation that needed to be had. And then, you know, my coach and me, you know, we kind of made a good decision on both of our parts.
I'm actually fascinated by like guys who kind of come out of the woodwork in the Cape. Like I just pulled up your numbers while you're talking. 13 appearances, 14 and two thirds, 23 strikeouts and three walks, like up to 96. Like, was this something like you were doing it and guys just didn't know about it? Was it one of those things where it was just, hey, the bright lights are on, there's scouts everywhere, I'm pitching against dudes from, you know, big time SEC, ACC schools now? Mm-hmm. Like, what was it where you, I mean, you obviously had a great year at Lemoyne as a sophomore, but, you know, doing that exact same kind of stuff at the Cape League is next level.
Yeah. Yeah. That was definitely a new world to me, you know, playing guys, you know, that you watch in the College World Series and things like that. But yeah, the bright lights were on. So, you know, I was kind of saying, you know, it's time for me to put up in front of these scouts, in front of these players. And, you know, I scuffled in my first two outings out there, but then, you know, hit my stride again. And, you know, had ended off with a great summer going into junior year. But yeah, out there, you know, that level of baseball is a different level. And, you know, going from Division II to that level, it definitely opens your eyes to what other competition is out there. And you either, you know, step up to the plate or, you know, you kind of get left at the wayside. And I definitely stepped up to the plate and, you know, I enjoyed that summer a lot.
What was your path from like a pure pitch mix standpoint? Kind of, I know historically we get like athletic shortstops or like converted catchers. It's like, all right, here's a guy with some arm speed, teach him a slider and keep your fingers crossed that it all works out. Like, were you a guy who could pitch a lot more? Was it that you could fall back on your belly? Like, how did your, I know now you're throwing two breaking balls, there's a change up, you know, there's vertical approach angle discussions. What were you back when you were, you know, when you were just closing at Lemoyne?
So I was mainly fastball, curveball. And then my sophomore year going into the Cape, you know, I just one day getting ready for that, I was like, you know what, I need a slider. And sort of just picked up a grip off Twitter, I'm sure, maybe Ninja or something like that. Yeah. And kind of just started rolling with it. And then, you know, I was fastball slider out there in the Cape and, you know, progressed with that. You know, always had a little change up, but never threw it much because the fastball and slider were, you know, just pretty great pitches to both side hitters. And then, you know, getting into pro ball, obviously added a curveball, but, you know, working up through, you know, the Cape and then my junior year, I was mainly fastball slider changeup.
So you know, fast forwarding, obviously you put up some like stupid numbers. I think it was like 11-0 in 13 starts as a junior and you're drafted by the Reds. One of the things I'm always fascinated to talk about is like, you know, I think in baseball, sometimes we make the mistake of trying to like coach the different out of players. Like when we see something unique, they try to fit it to the mold. And, you know, big leaguers aren't average. They're outliers across the board. You see guys like, you know, Taylor Rogers and Adam Simber thrown from like really low slots. You see like Oliver Drake is, you know, throwing from like a left-handed four seam release point because he's got so much lateral trunk tilt. Yours is unique, right? There's a ton of knee flexion on the front leg. It's a unique attack angle because your vertical release height is lower. You know, I'm curious, was this always who you were? Was it just, you know, how you were? Is it something you discovered? That's part one of the question.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't really, I guess, know myself or know my delivery and I guess the uniqueness of it until I got traded over to the Dodgers in 2019. You know, I knew I had a low release height, I guess you can say. Guys were always saying, like, that ball got up on me. Yeah. And that, you know, true life, true carry. But I didn't really know until, you know, the Dodgers sort of sat me down and were like, okay, you know, this is a quote-unquote picturesque pitcher, you know, with lead leg block and over the top and, you know, higher three-quarter arm slot, this and that. You know, this is you, you know. Not much lead leg block, lower three-quarter release, back knee sometimes touching the ground. Don't coach that out of yourself. You know, you're going to have different coaches that are going to be like, hey, we want to switch up something when something's going wrong. And they were like, basically, no. Like, this is what you do. This is what you do well. We want you to just optimize it, basically.
Yeah.
So going from there, you know, they sort of just optimized it, didn't tinker with my delivery too much and you know, just let me feel comfortable in what I do. And, you know, here I am, you know, that was 2019 and here I am 2022, you know, with pretty much the same mechanics and feeling as good as ever.
I think the thing that folks like to fall in love with when they see like a, I guess, a lower slot like that is, hey, just go to a two seam, right? It's going to fit everything, you know, from like a spin axis standpoint, it's probably going to work. And what they forget is like, when you see a four seam that carries from such a low slot, like, you know, Scherzer obviously does it. Hader is another, you know, big name, and Joe Ryan with the Twins is now doing it as well. It's, you can kind of get away with four seams that other guys can't get away with, yep. Right? So those guys need to be up at like the letters, and sometimes those belt high fastballs, you know, carry even more from a different attack angle. So were the Dodgers actually, you know, using those discussions of attack angle with you, like comparing you to norms, or was it just saying, hey, you know, you're unique? Like, I know you're really bright with this stuff and you like to get granular at times. Did you have to tread water lightly with that? What, did they give it to you in like smaller doses, or did you ask for all the data early on?
Definitely smaller doses. I guess I wasn't really introduced to attack angle until 2020. You know, our alternate site year, COVID year. And I had seen articles about it, but I didn't really understand it. And, you know, in asking questions with some of the PD guys over there, they were kind of like, all right, you know, we're going to talk about this a little bit more, but we're not going to, you know, go over the top with it. And then I guess last year, you know, was when it sort of became mainstream, and, you know, it was in a lot of discussions. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm definitely, you know, an outlier in respect to, you know, vertical approach angle, attack angle, things like that. So I kind of just ran with it. You know, I know I can get away with some pitches that other guys can't. But obviously sometimes, you know, you get too cute with that and it comes back to bite you.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely had those conversations, and now I feel like I'm well-versed in it and can know, pass on that information to a lot of new guys.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you're looking for carry, right? If you're trying to get away with pitches up the zone, and, you know, historically speaking, like what will you see? Well, you'll see guys that do it with velo or high spin, you know, some guys do it with extension, you know, but very few people kind of take into account that sometimes the angle at which you're attacking, you know, really, really matters. And it's interesting, like you're playing in Washington right now, like Sean Doolittle, Steve Cishek, both guys who are like big extension stuff. Cishek's added a four seam like from a lower slot later in his career, and it served him well. So those guys are just doing it via different avenues to be successful top of the zone. So it's just like, it's a good lesson to young pitchers, like understand why you're actually successful, because you're just taking guesses when you tinker. Did you actually run into scenarios where it was coached out of you? Like where people were really aggressive on like lead leg blocking or trying to get your slot up or changing the pitch mix? Like, did you have to have hard conversations with folks, or did you kind of like get to the Dodgers soon enough that you're out ahead of it?
Yeah. You kind of put that, those words in my mouth. You know, I got to the Dodgers soon enough to where, you know, a lot wasn't coached out of me, but, you know, after getting drafted, things like that, I had some quirks that were attempted to be worked out of me, and, you know, they never really felt good, and I never knew why they were being coached to me. But, you know, in joining the Dodgers organization and coming over here to the Nationals, you know, they just let me be me. You know, there are certain things that, you know, say, hey, do this, and I'll be like, my body just, one, it doesn't like that, and two, it just doesn't feel good. You know, I'm in a zone right now to where, you know, I can, you know, have a educated conversation with a coach or anyone like that and be like, all right, this is what I think, you know, let's talk about it and kind of say, this feels good, this doesn't feel good. But yeah, there's definitely instances when those things, I guess, are attempted to be coached out of you. But, you know, I feel like I'm in a position now to where, you know, I can speak knowledgeably about, you know, my body and the way I feel like it works and kind of just go from there.
Absolutely. As a friendly reminder, this episode is brought to you by Proteus Motion. Proteus's resistance training is known as 3D resistance, and it's revolutionizing the way that we can train athletes in a variety of planes of motion, and also the way that we can test those athletes to best design programs to make them successful.
We used Proteus at Cressy Sports Performance for the past few years and collaborated them to develop the Cressy Power Test for rotational athletes. If you're working with baseball players, this is a must-have tool for making sure that you design the right kind of programs for your athletes to get them to where they want to be as quickly and safely as possible. The Proteus allows you to train various points rotationally on the force velocity curve in ways that you just can't get with medicine balls, weighted bats, things like that. Again, you can learn more about Proteus at proteusmotion.com. Again, that's proteusmotion.com, proteusmotion.com.
I'm intrigued about your 2020. So obviously that was an interesting year because we had guys that took huge steps back in 2020. And then I also know a lot of guys that went off the grid, like trained their butts off and added 3 or 4 ticks. So between the minor league season being canceled and you getting injured, you, for all intents and purposes, you missed the year. I want to say it was like 3 appearances or something like that. But you came out very strong in 2021. You know, you made a major league debut, got traded, and, you know, really established yourself as a big league regular. So I'm curious, like, when you look back at 2020, was getting hurt a little bit of a blessing in disguise? Did you learn a lot about who you are and what makes you mm-hmm. successful during that timeline?
Yeah. So I actually got hurt last year in 2021. But 2020, yeah, that was an interesting year, you know, being at the alternate site all year. And, you know, we had studs, you know, we were facing every day. And it was sort of tough at first, you know, because being, I guess, in the live BP setting every fifth day, you know, you don't want to throw inside as much. You don't want to, you know, I guess, get too overly excited, you know, in the scenario, just because it's kind of tough to, and those guys have seen you, you know, 20 times already. And it was tough at first, but, you know, towards the end of that, you know, I kind of hit my stride in terms of just, you know, going out there and competing, knowing I was getting my work in the best situation possible. That wasn't the big leagues. And I was, you know, developing, and I ended up coming out of that with a better refined curveball, you know, which is one of my go-to weapons now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just competing, you know, being able to compete. And, you know, at the end of that, got to join the Dodgers on their postseason run and be there for the World Series win and things like that. But, you know, it was definitely a different year in terms of just not having games to go out there and compete and just having to, you know, every fifth day, hey, we're going to give you a live BP. You're going to throw 4 or 5 sets. And, you know, this is the best option we have for you right now.
You know, it's interesting. We always talk in like coaching about really coaching is giving athletes safe spaces where they can fail and figure things out, right? And, you know, sometimes you use constraint-based training. You try to lead them to the answer and, you know, you give them external focus cues to, you know, take the focus on themselves away. Like, to be honest, like 2020 was kind of like this big experiment in like, hey, let's let athletes just go and compete, figure things out, take away consequences, right? There's no fans in the stands yelling at you. Nobody's like counting what your ERA was. It probably didn't even get posted online. It was just, you know, you and coaches competing. And we had kids at the facility. I mean, whether it was the Ivy League doing their season here or, you know, a bunch of minor leaguers trying to get 80 or 90 innings. Like, just so many guys actually got better at a time when we thought people were going to get substantially worse. That
of course.
Kind of a lesson is maybe we overcoach kids. Maybe we get in the way sometimes. Like when you look back on that time, was it just a matter of like having a chance to fail when it didn't matter?
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt, you know, going out there and just being told like, hey, we're here to develop, you know, we want you guys to like take this serious because, you know, 2021, you're not going to have any, restrictions, you know, we're going to want you to go out there in 2021 and, you know, hit the ground running. And having that element of just, you know, 3 months of development while also competing definitely helped a lot of guys. I know it helped me, you know, guys off the top of my head, Bobby Miller, Ryan Pepio, you know, guys that are going to make their debut this year, Andre Jackson, you know, a lot of guys from that list are going to eventually be big leaguers. And I think a lot of them, if you talk to them about it and ask them reflect on it, you know, they'll say they had a great time there just being able to develop and become, you know, better baseball players in a great organization.
You alluded to using that time to develop the curveball. And now you have like 2 stellar, you know, breaking pitches that you throw in. What's interesting is it looks like, you know, kind of like how you've used things has changed. Like the curve usage has gone up, the slider usage has gone up, you know, or going down, excuse me, over the years just because of the development of that pitch. you know, let's maybe talk like conceptually about it. It sounds like you had the curveball before the slider, you know, like, and then, you know, got a little slider happy and then came back and used the curveball more. Would that maybe describe the way it's played out?
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of the way it's always gone. You know, went to college with, you know, a little breaking ball and had a decent breaking ball my sophomore year, then went to the Cape, developed a slider and, you know, threw that all throughout my first year in pro ball. And then joining the Dodgers, you know, we developed a little spike curveball, knuckle curveball, and that's sort of been the most recent development. Definitely refined that in 2020 at the alternate site, like we talked about. And I've always had the slider, you know, that was my go-to pitch in 2019, you know, when I ended up being their minor league pitcher of the year. And then even last year, you know, having both breaking balls, you know, was a huge advantage to me because I throw them both hard. You know, the movement is different, but it's not too different. And, you know, I can command them pretty well. So it was definitely advantageous to, you know, have those weapons to both hitters. And I think it's going to, you know, continue to work out for me and being able to throw those.
I was going to ask you about it because they're interesting. They're basically within like two ticks of each other. Like they're not crazy differentiated. So I'm actually kind of intrigued to hear like the thought process behind, you know, what you're doing with, you know, with each one of them. Like what are your mindsets on a curveball versus a slider?
Yeah, it's more so the mindset of the curveball. There was a moment in 2020 at the alternate site where, you know, I was sitting around the same velo with both of the pitches and had a coach sort of ask me like, what are you thinking? What do you think about, you know, taking a couple ticks off the curveball, you know, in terms of just throwing it slower, maybe trying to get more break. And I was like, I understand, but I just don't think I'd be able to do that authentically. I think it would cause a lot of disruption in my delivery, maybe throw off something to the hitter, this or that. So they were like, okay, just continue to throw the curveball hard, throw your slider hard, you know, and try and just throw them as hard as you can. And, you know, having the tracking data of last year, you know, they're one, you know, the slider's going to have a little bit more backspin with a little bit of horizontal break, while the curveball, you know, is going to have a little bit more vertical break with a little bit of horizontal break. And this year, actually, the curveball has had a lot more vertical break in terms of averages. And, you know, it never was, hey, we want more break on this. It was always just throw it hard, command it at the bottom of the zone, command it in the strike zone, early in counts, get hitters to chase late and kind of just roll with it. And that's always been my mentality. I don't think that'll ever change.
Are you conceptually thinking about like trying to get to the front of a curveball, or is it just trust the grip, no matter what?
Yeah, for both pitches, actually, I'm trying to think to get to the front of the ball, because if you're to see, you know, my hand on a slow-mo camera and Edgertronic, you'll see I come off the side of it just because I'm so much of a pronator, which aids my the backspin on my fastball. Yeah. But, you know, it takes away from me being able to get to the front of the baseball. So I'll never get, you know, that sweeper 20 inches of left break, you know.
It's an overcorrection you have to make in your mind.
Yeah, I'll get the 3 to 5 inches of lateral break, but I'll be able to throw it hard and it'll be sharp and late, and you know the hitter will think it's fastball and it just won't be.
Yeah. You know, so switching gears a little bit, like we got to see you in action, you know, this offseason at the facility, and your duty takes crazy pride in your prep. I respect that a lot about you. I'm curious, you know, about your in-season routines, right? Obviously, like the transition from a 7-day rotation in college to a 5-day rotation is one that a lot of guys struggle with, and you're kind of learning to bounce back on a 5-day. Did you have a hard time adjusting to that between the Reds and the Dodgers?
Yeah, I would say I hit a wall sort of right after I got drafted, you know, going from the 7-day to the 5-day with a bullpen in between. It was definitely hard on me, and I just didn't know how to, you know, tailor my workload, I guess, to the 5-day. I was so set on the 7-day, and, you know, it took a while, but once, you know, I hit my stride in my first full season, you know, then it got a little bit easier. And then, you know, 2020 wasn't a normal year, but then last year, you know, going back to the 5-day routine, you know, it definitely, it takes a lot out of you, but it's a routine that, you know, it takes a little time to adjust, and I definitely had my time to adjust, and I think, you know, it's benefited me a lot being in those routines.
So with that said, now we're trying to turn it into a 200 inning season. So talk to me about what your 5 day looks like right now. I know obviously early in the season, sometimes there's days with rainouts. I had one of those the other day actually, but maybe talk throwing schedule. So if day zero is your start, what's happening day one, two, three, and four?
Yeah. So day one, you know, I'll have like a light toss, 90 feet, 120 feet, just get the arm moving, get the body moving, you know, cause the next day I got a bullpen. So try to take it light. And then we do some movement stuff in the weight room, not be too intensive, keep the workload light with some light, moderate running. And then day two, you know, that'll be my day. I really get after it with some high intensity. So that'll be, you know, your long toss and bullpen day, and then get some conditioning in while getting a workout in, a full body workout. Day three will sort of be, we'll tailor it back, try to lower the intensity just a little bit. I like to get out a little bit, so I'll be in like the 150 range, you know, just feeling it. I might touch the mound for 10 or so pitches, nothing crazy. I normally do it just to feel spin off the slope. Try to get on the mound like twice in between starts. It's just something I've adapted to, just to get that spin. And then, you know, that'll be like a lower intensity workout as well. Day four, you know, that'll be your day that, you know, your intensity is probably the lowest, where, you know, we'll have like what we call like a CNS workout. So it'd be like quick, short rep stuff, kind of just priming the nervous system, some sprints, priming the nervous system as well. And that'll be like a light catch day. And then day five, day zero will be start day and go out there and do your thing. But yeah, my routines have like sort of changed throughout the years. You know, I was always a day after a start, I was always a lower body lift. Day two, bullpen, upper body lift. Day three, sort of movement day. But in having conversations with you, having conversations with our strength coaches, you know, having the advantage of, you know, compacting those higher intensity days just made more sense.
And fluctuations. Yeah.
Yeah. I've felt great, you know, having that transition. And I think that's what I'm going to rock with this year.
Yeah. I think it's always about knowing how deep you can dig the hole. Right. So, you know, some guys have phenomenal work capacity and, you know, they throw on day zero and then they go out and they crush a lower body lift and then they throw day two pen and, you know, they're running gassers. Then day three is an upper body day and they just kind of like pray that day four is going to be enough to actually feel good. And those conversations with those guys, like, they actually have forgotten what it's like to actually feel good.
Yeah.
The easiest way to get through them is just like, hey, like, just bang your lifts on this rotation, take a week off from lifting and come back. And it's very eye opening for them because fatigue masks fitness. And at the end of the day, no matter how hard you work is if you're always digging that hole. So we just try to find an easy day inside day of one or two. You know, it tends to be easiest on a day three pen. You're a day two guy, and that's fine. You just got to figure out how you're going to kind of consolidate stuff.
So, of course.
Super useful stuff. You know, one thing you touched on was your long tossing. And actually, we never had this conversation. I've seen you long toss, but maybe never conceptually discussed it, is like being, you know, a lower slot guy. How does that play when you long toss? Do you still like to take it out really, really far? Do you change your slot when you do long toss and then bring it back down, you know, when you're pulling down? C-Sheck's a teammate. He's a guy who, you know, usually kind of lowers as he comes in from it.
Yeah, I'm kind of like that. You know, I try to, once I get, you know, to a good distance, I definitely get some loft on the ball. So probably raise my arm just up a tick. But, you know, as I come back in and, you know, get closer to 120, 90 feet, you know, that's when, you know, I start to dial it in, you know, throw from the stretch, you know, put some gas behind it, I guess you can say. But yeah, long toss has always been sort of been something I've done. And it's been a part of my schedule since all I can know, I guess. But yeah, I love the benefits of long toss. It makes you feel good. And I think it honestly keeps your arm in shape. I'm sure there are some studies out there that might debunk that, but yeah, it's always been something I've done, and even being the lower slot guy, I feel like it's helped.
With the two breaking balls, how much do you actually throw those in catch play? I know that's like a pretty debated point. You see guys like, I mean, Scherzer throws a ton of breaking stuff just in catch play to feel it. Mm-hmm. Other guys, I can't work on it unless I'm on the slope. Where do you stand on that discussion, especially because you have two different ones?
Yeah, I like to throw some early in my catch play and then, you know, go from heaters till my max distance. And then once I start bringing them in, you know, I like to do like five of each, you know, five curveballs, five sliders, five changeups. And then if, you know, I feel like that's not sufficient enough and I want to feel the slope, you know, on my day three or my day four, I'll go on the slope and feel a couple, try to feel like the front of the baseball, even though I'm not going to get to the front of the baseball, and kind of go from there. But yeah, I always try to feel, you know, that spin out of hand and just dropping it into the catcher's glove and commanding it left and right and going from there.
Right on. All right, it's time for the lightning round. We've hit some good stuff, so this will be the easy stuff. Who do you like to watch in today's game and why?
Oh, man, there's so many good guys to watch. But I would
so much easier to watch them, too. Like,
I would say it was a blast to watch Max Fried last night against the Dodgers. You know, he's throwing harder, and he throws so many pitches. It's amazing to watch, and he's been lights out this so far this year, and you know he's been great to watch.
He's one of those guys who's kind of flipping this whole like mass equals gas thing on its head that we kind of resigned ourselves to for so long. It's always cool to see whether these guys can sustain it and how they create velocity, because it's very different than what we thought 5 years ago.
He's electric for sure. Yeah.
Favorite teammate of all time and why?
So many good ones. Yeah. I would say the one that I keep in touch with the most, Andre Jackson with the Dodgers. You know, I was a groomsman at his wedding a few years ago. And, you know, we were roommates in high A ball and we played together for a long time. But, yeah, he's awesome. He made his debut last year and we keep in touch all the time. We just bounce things off each other. And he's probably my favorite teammate. And, you know, we're even texting right now. So, yeah, I'll go with Andre Jackson.
I like it. All right. In terms of the next step in your development, you know, we talked about this a lot this offseason, but you know, what do you think you need to do to take that next big jump?
I think with any big league pitcher, it's consistency. It's going out there and the team knows that you're going to give them 5-6 innings, if not more, of good baseball. You know, you're going to keep your team in the game and give them a chance to win. And I think that's the next bridge, you know, I'm going to close and go over, because you know, the stuff's there, this and that, but, you know, it's the consistency. It's eliminating, you know, those three-run, four-run innings. It's, you know, it's something Max Fried, Marcus Stroman, they excel at. You know, they might have runners on first and second, one out, but they find a way to only give up that one run, if not any. And so the consistency, just continuing to close the gap on that, and I think that's the next big step in my development.
I love it. That's a very good answer too. Last but not least, you know, we have a lot of like parents and kids that listen to these podcasts, you know, on the way to practice or games. I'm sure you've had a lot of those drives with your family. What's some advice that you would impart to some teenagers that are, you know, aspiring, you know, major leaguers that are listening to this?
Honestly, as cliche as it is, kind of just make sure you're using all your resources available. I think with today's world, there's so much out there on Twitter, Pitching Ninja, your Twitter, Kyle Bodie, things like that. There's so many resources out there that I feel like I benefited from as I was growing up and in college that I feel like kids might not be utilizing. And I think their pitching development or even their, you know, hitting development can go a long way in looking at these accounts and, you know, maybe reaching out, asking questions, just making sure that they're reaching out to all the avenues that are available, because, you know, there are a lot of guys that are knowledgeable that a lot of young baseball players look up to, but they don't reach out as much as they should. And I think that was a mistake I made growing up. And, you know, I encourage a lot of kids to just go out there and make these connections, you know, ask these questions. And I think it'll go a long way in developing their careers.
I love that. Hey man, there was lots of good stuff in here. Everybody's got to check you out. You're really good on your social media. There's always like a ton of really excellent content that you're both. yourself and sharing on both Instagram and Twitter.
Of course.
You're a stud. Appreciate your hard work this off season and this great podcast. Thanks for taking the time, man.
Absolutely, Eric. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care, bud.
Thank you.